if we look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth, it was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before. Those who say that we're in a time when there are no heroes, they just don't know where to look. The sloping hills of Arlington National Cemetery, with its row upon row of simple white markers bearing crosses or stars of David, they add up to only a tiny fraction of the price that has been paid for our freedom. As for the enemies of freedom, those who are potential adversaries, they will be reminded that peace is the highest aspiration of the American people. We will negotiate for it, sacrifice for it. We will not surrender for it now or ever. We are Americans.
Welcome to Always Right Radio with Bob Frantz on AM 1420, The Answer.
And a good morning to you. Thank you so much for waking up and starting your day either with Hugh Hewitt and then continuing on to Always Right Radio, or if you just turn on the radio for the first time for this show. Either way, thank you. Appreciate you being here. A lot of choices we have each and every day. The fact that you choose to engage with us is very, very much appreciated. We do not take that for granted. It's a Tuesday, the seventh morning of the fifth month, year of our Lord, 2024. If I didn't say that already, that makes it a Kersenau day. Peter Kersenau will be with us an hour from now to provide his commentary and excellent analysis of all of the day's top news. Coming up in a half an hour, however, we're going to talk to the Secretary of State again. Frank LaRose will join us to talk about efforts that his office has undertaken to clean up voter rolls across the state of Ohio and to ensure that only American citizens who have legal registrations can cast votes in the state of Ohio, Ohio residents only. And to make sure that everybody only gets to vote once and that whatever precautions need to be taken to ensure a free and fair election are indeed free taken so that we have free and fair elections. So we'll talk to Secretary LaRose and Peter Kersenau on the program this morning. That means we have more time than oftentimes we have for you. Sometimes we're heavy on guests, sometimes a little less so. On the less so days, that means you fill the void. It's your time at 216-901-0945 and 888-281-1110. We'll get started with the top 9 at 9 in a moment. And by the way, I feel really good about it. I'll tell you after we do the pledge. I'll tell you the story about that in just a moment. Patriots, go ahead and stand and face your flag. Or if you're driving, just do the face your flag part. Works better that way. Standing in a car doesn't work well at all. I've tried it. But go ahead and look at your flag and put your hand on your heart if you're able to and join us for this pledge. If you are a believer in the true glory of this wonderful republic, this capitalist system that we have, if you are a believer in socialism, communism, DEI, and left-wing Democrat globalism, then you have no reason whatsoever to fake support for this country. So instead of standing proudly with the rest of us, go ahead and take a knee like the Marxist dog we know you to be. For those standing, however,
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
So what I was about to say is that I for the first time, I got something more than just a, yeah, I like the top 9 and 9, or no, I wish you'd go back to the monologues at the start of the show. Because I kind of was doing a little bit of an informal survey, only because people had been asking me about it. And so I said, yeah, let me throw it out there. And we got a few different responses. But somebody requested this. And hey, Nugget, this is on you. Somebody said, can you please save and post the top 9 at 9 every day? They like it, and they want to be able to refer back to what the top stories of the day are. And so Nugget Sausage Boy, he uploads our podcast every day. So there you go, a little extra job for you there. You think you can handle that, Nugget?
I think that if that person wants to give me more work, they should come here and help out.
That's a good answer, actually. But I know you'll get it done anyway. So, yeah, we do post the entire podcast of the whole show at the end of every show. And we post certain interviews, ones that are of particular note that stand out. And, yeah, we will post the top 9 and 9 separately. And I'll put it on the webpage. And from time to time, I may even put it on my social media so that you can grab it right there and make sure that you share it with anybody that you wish. Having said all of that,
it's 9 o'clock. Do you know where your headlines are? We do. It's time for the top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio.
All right, headline
number 1.
IDF begins Rafah offensive. The Israeli Defense Forces spokesperson said Monday night that the military conducted precise targeted strikes against Hamas terror targets in eastern Rafah. The prime minister's office said that the war cabinet had agreed to continue with Israel's planned Rafah operation. Quote, the war cabinet unanimously decided that Israel continue the operation in Rafah to exert military pressure on Hamas in order to promote the release of our hostages and other goals of the war. According to the Times of Israel, an Egyptian official says the operation appeared to be limited in scope for now. He and Hamas's Al-Aqsa TV say Israeli officials informed the Egyptians that the troops would withdraw after completing their targeted operation. On Sunday, Hamas fighters near Rafah cross the Rafah crossing fired mortars into southern Israel, killing 4 Israeli soldiers. A Palestinian security official and an Egyptian official confirmed that Israeli tanks have entered the southern Gaza town of Rafah. So limited in scope for now doesn't mean it's going to be for very long, does it?
Number 2.
Hamas suddenly begs for ceasefire with Israeli attack on Rafah looming. The Palestinian Hamas terror organization hurriedly Monday claiming that they had accepted a ceasefire just hours after Israel warned residents of Rafah, the last Hamas stronghold in Gaza, to evacuate due to the imminent invasion. International media reported Monday evening local time that Hamas had suddenly declared it had accepted the Egyptian and Qatari terms for a temporary ceasefire after holding out for weeks against agreeing to a deal with Israel. But Israeli officials reportedly said that Hamas was agreeing to terms that Israel never had proposed or accepted. The sudden urgency to have everything, may have had everything to do with Israel's pending attack as thousands of Palestinian civilians began leaving Rafah, a strategic town on the Egyptian border and the last place in Gaza that Israel has not fully entered. As Breitbart News reported earlier yesterday, Israel dropped leaflets on Rafah and used text messages, phone calls, and other methods to warn residents to escape the Al-Mawasi humanitarian zone at the coast and other places nearby. So, in other words, what that sounds like to me is that Hamas was all about the FA part of FAFO, but they're not real big fans of the FO part. In other words, they like to blank around. They don't like to find out. This was the find out portion. This is the find out portion, and now they're saying, okay, we'll take that ceasefire. Not going to work.
Number 3.
Corrupt New York judge threatens Trump with jail time. I wrote that headline. The unprecedented criminal trial of President Trump resumes this morning after the president was held again in contempt of court, fined, and threatened with jail time for future gag order violations. He was told that he'll be required to sit in the Manhattan courtroom for at least another 2 weeks. Monday's day in court began with Mershon, the judge, ruling on remaining alleged gag order violations and ruling once again that he did violate the rule. He imposed a gag order on Trump before the trial began, saying he cannot make or direct others to make public statements about witnesses with regard to their potential participation or about counsel on the case, other than Bragg, or about court staff, DA staff, or family members of the staff. The judge on Monday fined Trump another $1,000 for a Truth Social post about the trial and said he will now consider jail sentences for the former president if he violates the gag order again. Meanwhile, an attorney for Stormy Daniels says the porn star is likely to take the witness stand in the New York versus Trump trial today. Daniels is central to the prosecution's case. They argue that Trump covered up hush money payments to her ahead of the 2016 election in an effort to quash news of an affair. Trump allegedly paid Daniels $130,000 through his attorney, Michael Cohen, who is expected to testify later on in the trial. Meanwhile, attorney Michael Moore said on CNN that the prosecutors so far haven't proven anything yet relating to the falsification of records.
The case deals with have you falsified records as it relates to federal election law. And so that has not been accomplished yet. So they're moving that way to it. I mean, this is a paper case. Paper cases are not inherently interesting. This one is a little different because it involves a former president. But the prosecutor has to put some meat on the bone. So if you...
He has to put some meat on the bone. And Fat Alvin will try to do hey, exactly that.
Number four.
I'm sorry, he chews the meat off the bone. United States looks to suspend weapons shipments to Israel as they move on Rafah. This is the United States and the Biden regime literally completely abandoning our ally in the Middle East. The U.S. reportedly put a hold last week on a weapons shipment to Israel, a stunning diplomatic shift as Benjamin Netanyahu prepares to go against Biden's warnings and move into Rafah. The pause in large shipment of offensive weapons appears to be the first instance of Biden withholding U.S.-made arms from Israel since October 7th. Netanyahu hinted at tensions with the Biden administration in a statement on Holocaust Remembrance Day issued Sunday. In the terrible Holocaust, there were great world leaders who stood by idly. Therefore, the first lesson of the Holocaust is if we do not defend ourselves, nobody will defend us. And if we need to stand alone, we will stand alone, end quote. Former U.S. Ambassador to Israel David Friedman said, the weaponry that America needs appears to be withholding from Israel is very precise and very accurate. It will assist Israel in minimizing civilian casualties in Rafah when it begins its battle to eradicate the four Hamas battalions that continue to threaten Israel and its citizens. What exactly is the U.S. hoping to accomplish here? That's a hell of a question. Does Joe Brandon have an answer for that? Why is he sending every single thing we can find to Ukraine so they can defend themselves, but not and literally withholding from Israel things that they need to defend themselves against the terrorist Palestinians?
Number five.
One more on Hamas. The Hamas leader praises campus protests, expresses desire to destroy Israel. A top leader in one of the world's largest terror organizations praised the Hamas protests that have been going on college campuses all over America for the last 2 weeks, saying they are causing Joe Biden to weaken his support for Israel. Did you catch that? The remarks late last week from Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem were translated by the Middle East Media Research Institute. Quote, Biden is under internal and external pressure because of his policy and approach. The pressure within America is more significant. He is at risk of losing the election because of Gaza. When the American people take a stand in support of Gaza, we salute and applaud them. He said the end quote. He said the Iranian-backed terror group, which is based in Lebanon, hopes that the protests so drastically shift public sentiment in the U.S. that America will no longer support Israel to such an extent. Without support, Israel is nothing. We would not have to work hard in order to destroy Israel. Without support, it will be destroyed. Now, I want to just ask you to do a math lesson with me here and ask and tell me whether or not 1 plus 1 equals 2. Hamas's leadership says, if the U.S. stops supporting Israel, we will destroy them. Joe Biden says, we are going to stop supporting Israel. 1 plus 1 equals what? It equals two, and that, yes, Joe Biden will contribute to the destruction of Israel if he stays on this current path.
Number six.
MIT backtracks DEI faculty requirements because, quote, they don't work. How about this? MIT will no longer require diversity statements in its faculty hiring process, making it the first elite university to abandon DEI. The decision was made by MIT President Sally Kornbluth, with support from the school's provost and six academic deans. Quote, my goals are to tap into the full scope of human talent, to bring the very best to MIT, and to make sure they thrive once here. We can build an inclusive environment in many ways, but compelled statements impinge upon freedom of expression, and they don't work. MIT embraced the diversity statement trend in late 2023. The university's department of, listen to this now, their Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering sought an assistant professor. in fields from fundamental nuclear science to practical applications of nuclear technology and energy security and quantum engineering. Sounds very specific in terms of its requirements, doesn't it? But applicants for a job in nuclear science and engineering were required to submit a statement regarding their views on race and diversity, inclusion, and belonging. Such requirements have long been controversial, and the basic argument against them is simple. Diversity, equity, and inclusion has come to connote a set of controversial views about identity, power, and oppression. What the hell does any of that have to do with nuclear science and engineering? Thankfully, MIT has seen the nuclear light.
Number seven.
Biden's Title IX expansion could have schools calling CPS on parents. CPS, you asked? That's Child Protective Services. Joe Biden's Title IX ruling requires schools to call CPS on nonconforming parents. Since Biden's sweeping revision to Title IX rules, much of the focus has been on how the updates impact female athletes. That's far from the only concern. Critics quickly pointed out that those updates could be used to protect trans-identifying males from competing on women's sports teams. But according to the former Assistant Secretary of the Department of Education, it also means that schools could be mandatory reporters of suspected abuse. Rather, schools are already mandatory reporters of suspected abuse, and the schools could then be required to report parents who don't support their gender-affirming athletes at the school to CPS. Quote, with policies reflecting the Education Department's position that refusing to treat someone consistent with gender identity damages mental health, schools will now have to consider reporting non-affirming parents to Child Protective Services. So not only does Biden's new expansion of Title IX impact women and girls, now it impacts parents and how they can raise their children as well.
Number eight.
Top New York Times editor suggests White House wants paper to act like communist propaganda arm for the president. Gee, you think? A top editor at the New York Times suggested to Semaphore in an interview that the White House wants the paper to act like a communist propaganda arm for Joe Biden ahead of the election. Those close to Biden have previously stated that the New York Times had been failing in its coverage by not being more favorable to the White House, according to Politico. The Times executive editor Joe Kahn responded in an interview with Semaphore to some of those complaints that the outlet does not see its role in the media as saving democracy or stopping an authoritarian from taking power. Quote, it's our job to cover the full range of issues that the people have. At the moment, democracy is one of them, but it's not the top one. Immigration appears to be at the top of the polls, and the economy and inflation is second. Should we stop covering these things because they're favorable to Trump and minimize them? I don't even know how it's supposed to work in the view of Dan Pfeiffer of the White House. We became an instrument of the Biden campaign. We turn ourselves into the Xinhua news agency or Pravda and put out a stream of stuff that's very, very favorable to them and only negative about the other side. And that would accomplish what? End quote. Well, I think I can answer that for him. It would accomplish what it accomplished in 2020 when you and the rest of the mainstream media did exactly those things. It accomplished the presidency of Joseph R. Biden.
Number nine.
And finally, medical professionals asked the court to block transgender experimentation on minors in Ohio. Love this. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, AAPS, has filed an amicus brief in the Supreme Court of Ohio to defend kids against transgender operations. The brief supports the Saving Ohio Adolescents from Experimentation Act and the Save Women's Sports Act. The Ohio Constitution embodies natural law, the brief states, and natural law stands against creating special transgender rights. Children cannot provide informed consent for transgender operations that mutilate them. Jane Orient, medical doctor, states as executive director of AAPS, the brief argues that the transgender operations on children further violate the requirement of medical ethics to do no harm. Quote from Jane Orient, HB 68 embodies the natural law principle of self-defense for the benefit of children against transgender procedures. HB 68 is analogous to laws against statutory rape, which no one would claim are unconstitutional, according to the brief. And there you have it.
This has been the Top 9 at 9 on Always Right Radio. AM 1420, The Answer.
All right, there you go, your Top 9 at 9. It's 9:26 now. We'll take a time out. We'll come back and talk to the Secretary of State about elections in Ohio. Did they get everything cleaned up on the voter rolls? What kind of confidence should we have in the upcoming election being free, fair, and accurate? We'll talk to Frank Luros next on AM 1420.
The Answer.
Okay, it is 9:34. Thanks for being with us on AM 1420. The Answer. We will have the Top 9 and 9 set up for you and isolated so that you can use it, share it, listen to it again, whatever it is that you want to. But those are the top headlines of the day as I see it. Kirsten Owl will join us from the United States Commission on Civil Rights. That'll be at 10:10 this morning. But now let's talk about the elections. Let's talk about whether or not we can count on a free, fair, and more importantly, accurate election in 2024. We're just now we're under 6 months. I think we're under the six month mark now. So we are obviously going to decide whether or not this republic carries on and continues to be a republic, or whether or not it's going to become some sort of globalist socialist hellhole. That's literally what this is. This comes down to: is every American citizen who has the right to vote going to be able to cast a vote that will be counted? Is every American who is not a citizen but is a resident here going to be allowed to have a vote that is counted? Those are some of the problems. What about people who try to vote twice? What about people with two different addresses? Can we count on an accurate election? That is going to be up to the Secretary of State and every single state. Ours is Frank LaRose, who joins us now on AM 1420, The Answer, to talk about those efforts. Secretary LaRose, good to have you back. How are you?
Good to be back, Bob, and you're right. It's 181 days, 15 hours, and 24 minutes until the polls open. And we take this work seriously. It's list maintenance that we're focused on right now. That's removing dead people from the rolls, removing and making sure non-citizens are not registered, making sure that when people move that they are removed from the rolls as well. The Democrats rip their garments and gnash their teeth and call it purging the rolls. We call it taking bad data out of the voter rolls so that we know we can have an accurate and honest election. And that's what we're doing right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't quite really understand what the problem with purging the rolls is, whether you think that's a pejorative type term or not. I mean, you know, cleaning up bad data, purging the rolls. Yeah, if there are names on the voter rolls that should not be there for one reason or another, they've moved out of Ohio, they've passed away, whatever the case might be, they should be purged. Those names should be purged so that we do have an easier to track election, right? That's what the goal is.
Sure, that's it. And listen, it's important that we do this carefully. We don't want anyone to show up at the polls on election day and realize that they're no longer a registered voter. But when we follow the process to make sure that, for example, the process we're following right now is about removing those that have moved. If you filled out a national change of address form, went on the Postal Service website and notified the USPS that you have moved, we watch your voter rolls for 4 years. If there's 4 years of inactivity and you don't respond to the mailings we send you, then yes, we go ahead and cancel your voter registration. I think that's the right number of safeguards that need to be in place. And by the way, it's also what the law requires us to do. So this shouldn't be controversial whatsoever.
No, it shouldn't. But yet, you know, you pointed out, and I'm glad you did, about the way the Democrats frame this. And I'm looking at your tweet from Friday. In response to a tweet from Ohio, the Ohio Democratic Party on Friday, they've got a little screenshot of the Columbus Dispatch. And the Dispatch's headline says, "Voter fraud exceedingly rare in Ohio, detected in 0.0005% of 2020 ballots." And then their caption, "Voter fraud is exceedingly rare in Ohio, but LaRose is purging voters to score political points. The Ohio GOP puts politics over people always." I'll let you respond to that here, maybe the way you did on Twitter.
Yeah, listen, this is like saying that carjackings are exceedingly rare, so we should just stop enforcing the law when they occur. Like, it's foolish logic. We keep elections honest in Ohio, and we keep voter fraud relatively rare by doing just this, by enforcing the law and making sure that it is both easy to vote and hard to cheat. And by the way, this narrative that the Democrats have about somehow voter suppression, making it hard to vote, even their own people don't believe it. The vast majority of Ohioans, Republicans and Democrats, agree that it is easy to vote in Ohio and want us to take smart steps to keep it hard to cheat as well.
So, Secretary Lawrence, I want to respond, or get you to respond, rather, to a comment made underneath that very tweet by former Senate candidate Mark Pukita, who is critical of some things in the way Ohio's elections are run. He wrote, quote, "Except that according to a report Frank LaRose's office has had since January from United Sovereign Americans, which he's been unwilling to release to the public, voter fraud is not exceedingly rare in Ohio." I don't know about that report. Can you speak to it?
Yeah, and I don't know what Mark's talking about. On many things, he's often misinformed and just kind of looking for attention. But I'll say this. We were sent a letter by a group that claimed that they found a bunch of instances of inaccuracies in the voter registration database. We offered to meet with that group. They haven't taken us up on that offer at this point. But I can tell you what we do is an annual process. And so we have several things that sort of occur in parallel. We remove deceased voters every month. That's a monthly process that I actually set up when I was a state legislator that gets the list from the Department of Health and then removes the dead people every month. We have an annual process that removes those that moved out of state or within the state. We have an annual process that finds and removes non-citizens. We have an ongoing process that identifies those that have become inactive for a period of time and removes them. So all of these things occur on a routine basis. You can find at any given time inaccuracies in a voter registration list of 8 million people. As we've been on the air, someone has died, someone has turned 18, gotten married and changed their name. So the voter rolls are a very dynamic thing. The fact is, though, that we view this as like hygiene, like you brush your teeth every day. We conduct voter list maintenance on a daily basis. And by the way, Ohio does this better than probably any other state in the country.
So, I'm looking at that report, or actually it's an article about that report right now that's on the CanadaFreePress.com website, which apparently is the sister to America's Free Press. Ohio volunteers uncover massive irregularities in Ohio voter database. This is dated March 24th, so it's pretty current here, but it refers back to 2021 and 2022 and some of the research that was done there. So you're saying that the report that they're speaking of that they say is in the Secretary of State's office is not something you have seen?
No, we've seen it. They sent us a letter that said, hey, we found all of these problems with the voter registration database. What our desire was to meet with them and talk about their methodology. How do they arrive at these data points and that kind of thing? And again, they have not been willing to meet with us. They are threatening a lawsuit, which makes it harder for us to actually sit down and work. But the fact is, they want the same thing I want, which is to make sure that our voter lists are up to date. The funny thing is, I'm constantly getting criticized by the left. Appears to be criticism for the right for not doing enough voter list maintenance. The fact is, this is something we take very seriously and we work on every day. I'll give you an example, Bob, of something that people sometimes cite. You will find on occasion in the voter roll a date of birth where the birth year is listed as 1800. Now, we know that that's incorrect. We also know that that is in the state law as the placeholder when they don't have the right year. So when somebody fills out their voter registration form, if they refuse to provide the year, then the Boards of Elections are allowed to put in 1800 as a placeholder because that field can't be blank. Now, again, that's something we work hard to try to avoid. There is nobody actually born in 1800, but it is a data irregularity that occurs in otherwise accurate voter registrations. Now, these are the kind of things that when we sit down and talk with them, folks can, realize that we're doing the best we can as far as actually maintaining the accuracy.
Well, that's where I wanted to go with this. We're talking to Secretary of State Frank LaRose, and I want this to be clear. I don't think you're doing anything nefarious, and I don't think you're doing anything intentionally wrong. I think this is probably a very difficult thing to do, to maintain accurate voter rolls, because of all of the reasons you just said, all of the things that happened. People are dying as we're talking right now. People are moving. People are changing addresses. All of these things happen, and therefore their precincts change and so forth. So it's got to be very, very difficult to do. Having said that, I want to just read a couple of these that are in the report. According to, this says, the day after certification in 2022, the Ohio statewide voter roll database showed, among other things, 158,209 resided in an apartment or mobile home lot but had no unit number as required on their voter registration application to ensure proper delivery of mail, including mail-in ballot material. 4,143 were older than the oldest person in the United States at the time or were too young to legally register, but they were on the rolls. 6,348 had a date of birth that was different in 2022 than the date listed for them in 2020. And so it goes on like this, 253,000 this, 120,000 that, 240,000 this. They're pretty significant things, and when you add all of those up, we are talking about something that is much larger than 0.0005%, or whatever that, you know, whatever that minuscule number was as far as inaccuracies in the rolls. So this is the thing that a lot of people... If we didn't have a stolen election, in my view, in 2020, we wouldn't be as alarmed about this, but we did. There were voter irregularities and voter fraud, I think, committed all over the country or in a lot of places around the country in 2020. So now here we are in 2024, Mr. Secretary, and we want to make sure that everything is perfect, as impossible as perfect might be.
What I'd like to encourage every Ohioan to do, particularly those that can hear your voice and mine right now, is to just simply go to voteohio.gov and make sure their voter registration is up to date. There's also a personal responsibility here to make sure if you've moved, if you've gotten married and your name has changed. Or, for example, go check it to make sure there wasn't a data entry error by your Board of Elections. Here's one of the challenges that we face here in Ohio, Bob, is how decentralized our process is. We don't have a statewide voter registration database that I maintain autonomously. What we have is 88 county lists that we aggregate together into a statewide list. So what that means is we've got 88 different sets of fingers on 88 different keyboards doing, I would hope, their level best to do data entry accurately, but sometimes things get misheard as a result of sure. maybe handwriting that they can't read or just a human error. And so those are the kind of things that we work to try to keep accurate. But again, listen, this is a problem in all 50 states. I think that Ohio does a better job of this than any other state in the country, but it's never perfect. And this is why when groups like this have something, I'd ask them to come to us instead of, you know, trying to make a name for themselves by filing a lawsuit or by, you know, holding events around the state. How about and come and meet with the folks that are responsible for this and show us your work, show us your data. And if there are things that we can correct, then I'd love to work with our boards of elections to do that. Again, this is something that we've got a whole team of people working on a daily basis to make sure that we keep it accurate. But as you mentioned, it is it's a challenging process to maintain a database of 8 million people.
Yeah, no question about it. And again, I want to emphasize, I don't think anybody, or at least maybe this organization is, I don't know if they have an axe to grind with you. I don't know if they think that you're doing things wrong or if you're doing things in a less than above board fashion. I don't know. All I do know is what it says here, that this is a group called, what are they called here? Well, it's Marley Hornick, co-leader of New York Citizens Audit, whose team identified similar inaccuracies in New York State data, that in 2023, Hornick and Harry Horry, an expert in cybercrime and election law, founded the United Sovereign Americans and developed a legal strategy for securing the validity of the 2024 election. So they're the ones who are behind this. And what you're telling me, Secretary LaRose, is that they are threatening to sue you without actually coming to you and saying, hey, here's what our concerns are, let's address these.
Sure, that's it. And listen, we want the same thing here. Again, I am working more aggressively than probably any other Secretary of State in the country to maintain the accuracy of our voter rolls. It's not the only thing that we do to protect election integrity. We also, of course, check IDs in Ohio. We also make sure that we inspect the machines before each election. We audit after every election. You and I have had these conversations as well. So
sure.
Voter list maintenance is a key aspect of protecting the integrity of our elections. It's not the only thing that we do, but it is something we work exceedingly hard on. I think that they should maybe focus some of their concerns in other states that don't bother to do this at all, where they've stopped removing dead people from the rolls, where they don't remove inactive voters from the rolls. I'm actively doing that, and it's something that we focus on each and every day.
Yeah, and I agree with you. You know, if there are states that are doing it worse than us, and I know there are, I do hope they are focused on those states. But to the extent that there may be, you know, errors or problems with our roles, I would hope that an organization like this would come to you and say, let's cooperate rather than become, you know, contentious about this. I don't know what the need for a lawsuit would be. I have never talked to them before. I just know I read the story about the report, and they say that you have it. So I wanted to find out where that was. I hope that they would consider coming to talk to you about it rather than putting this in a courtroom, unless they come to you and you say, you guys are quacks, I don't want to hear from you anymore. Then if they got to sue you to get your attention, okay, but you, it doesn't sound like you are unwilling to talk to them, right?
We are very focused on list maintenance. Now, I'm also constrained by the law, which, by the way, you don't want a Secretary of State that just does whatever he or she pleases. You want one that follows the law, and there are certain rules that we have to follow in both federal and state law as it relates to, you know, canceling registrations and that kind of thing. So, again, not a simple task, but one that we're very aggressively moving on, and other states are ignoring, unfortunately.
Yeah, and that is unfortunate indeed. We absolutely have to have a free, fair, and accurate election, especially in all of the swing states or the battleground states, whatever you want to call them, that are going to decide whether or not, as I said at the outset of our interview, whether or not we remain a functioning republic or we devolve into a globalist hellhole, because that is literally what this upcoming election is going to determine. Secretary of State Frank LaRose, thank you for coming on and letting us know about the efforts to make sure those voter rolls are accurate, and hopefully we can follow up and maybe we'll reach out to the this organization too to see if they are intending to reach out to you in a civil manner as opposed to making this a civil as in lawsuit type of case. So thank you so much. We appreciate that.
Amen, Bob. Lots at stake. Thank you, sir. Talk to you soon.
You better believe it. There sure is. Thank you, sir. That's Frank LaRose on AM 1420, The Answer. Yeah, Mark Pukita, I've heard of the report. I have not read the report, but I did read an article about the report, as I said. And it does... it does raise the red flags, I guess is a good way to say that. You know, at least the hair on the back of my neck stands up a little bit when I see some of these numbers saying, ooh. Because, you know, when 2020 and the theft of the presidential election happened, which is what I absolutely believe it to be, you know, we looked at Arizona, and we looked at Pennsylvania, and we looked at Georgia, and we looked at all of these places that had all of these irregularities. One of the states that was not included in that was Ohio. It wasn't even close. It was an 8-point Trump victory. There were no allegations of or concerns or whatever you want to call it of voter fraud on a widespread basis here. And we just figured we're doing it well. We're good. Ohio's cool. And then I see this report, and I'm like, wow. Again, not that anything went wrong in 2020 or 2022 here, but going forward, are we sure that we are going to continue to be, you know, the gold standard, if you will, in terms of election security and integrity? These numbers in this report tell us that there are some serious problems. I just read some of those to the secretary, and you heard them. I'll give you a couple more of them. 253,486 voters supposedly registered on January 1st, 84,221 voters registered on another federal holiday, and 201,693 registered on a Sunday. All of those times, the Board of Elections and state offices are closed. January 1st is a federal holiday. Other federal holidays and Sundays, how can these people be registering on those dates? That's a hell of a question. Are they legitimate registrations? Or are they, you know, illegal immigrants? Is something nefarious afoot here? I don't know what to make of that. I just know that it should be addressed. 120,094 had registration dates in the 2022 state voter file that were earlier than the registration date in the 2020 file. 59,025 more people were listed as registering to vote before they were born. You following this? And then finally, 243,583 had a state identification number that had changed since 2020, even though federal laws require each voter to be issued a unique state identifier. 34,233 had 2 to 5 registration records with different state identification numbers, making it impossible for them to vote more than once. I'm sorry, making it possible for them to vote more than once, beg your pardon, because they had 2 to 5 registration records, which means technically if they wanted to roll the dice, they could vote 2 to 5 times under each different registration number. I'm not saying Ohio's elections are corrupted. I'm not saying they're fraudulent. I'm not saying that they can't be trusted. I am saying these questions have to be answered. And according to the secretary, they have to be asked first. He's right. He said, yeah, we've seen the report, but the group that is responsible for it has not come to them and sat down and said, let's figure out what all this means. We'd like our answers. Instead, they're threatening to sue him. I don't know what to do about that. I guess what I would say is I would hope that the Secretary of State's office would look into this report independent of the group that found the numbers, independent of them, and said, let's figure out what happened in all of these. I don't know what kind of a staff it would take to do that. Again, he's right. In a state with 8 million registered voters, to comb through the rolls and every single voter identification number, state identification number, to figure out, you know, to look at the birth dates and to basically to, you know, justify everything to make sure everything was accurate and correct. I'm sure that would be a hell of an undertaking. I don't know what it would take, but it's something that's going to have to be done. It's going to have to be taken or undertaken. Otherwise, people are going to have questions. Like I said, we're not freaking out here because Joe Biden didn't win the presidency because at the last second there was a massive shift in votes overnight in 2020 in the state of Ohio. That didn't happen. That happened in Arizona. That happened in Georgia. That happened in Pennsylvania. There were serious questions in Wisconsin and so forth. None of those things happened in Ohio. So I'm not suggesting that it's like this is the, you know, this is the be all end all. Ohio's in a bad way here. But I don't want it to become that either. I want Ohio to continue to have a reputation as being a state that has gotten it right. That the voter rolls are accurate and that the results are accurate as well. And this is something that I would hope the Secretary of State's office will take up, like I said, independent of the organization that sent that information to them. All right, it's 9:55. We're going to take a time out here. We're going to clear the decks, and we're getting ready for Kersenow. It's a Kersenow Tuesday right here on Always Right Radio, AM 1420.
Noticing.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.
This is Always Right Radio on AM 1420, The Answer. With your host, Bob France.
All right. Onward we roll into hour number 2. It's 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Thanks for being with us. It's a Tuesday, the 7th morning of the 5th month in the year of our Lord, 2024. And as it is a Tuesday, that means it's a Kersenow Day!
You digger!
Everybody loves Kersenow Day. Peter Kersenow with us once again. He is a longest-serving member of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. He is an attorney. He is a law professor. He is, what else? He's a columnist. He's a best-selling author. Pete, you got a new book released now, right?
Yeah, coming out now, and it's called Zero Option. Again, I don't get to choose the titles, although I don't mind this one that much, although I don't know what it has to do with the plot of the book. But the publisher chooses it, unless you're somebody like Tom Clancy or J.K. Rowling, the publisher chooses. So, yeah, thanks for mentioning that. Please buy it so that my grandkids can go to college.
Well, why would you want us to sentence them to college?
Well, they're going to go to a good school no matter what, and I hope by the time they go to college, the lunacy will have abated. Although, you know, it seems as if the lunacy progresses the longer it goes on. The colleges need a major course correction. Maybe this is it. There have been a number of major donors who have decided to pool their funding from their respective alma maters. I know that a lot of my friends, I'm not one of those huge wealthy donors, but a lot of my friends, my former football teammates who have become millionaires and billionaires, have said no mas, and that gets their attention. It really does. And I think the saner people, the saner alums, and that's not a big bar to get over, but the saner alums are saying, no, you know, we're not financing this lunacy anymore. And I think it starts to get their attention. It's happening at Columbia. It's happening at a number of other places, Ivy League places. And it needs to happen even more.
Yeah, you know, and Peter, and by the way, Zero Option, I should say, is available for pre-order now. It looks like the release date is July 9th, according to what Amazon shows me right here. So July 9th is the actual release date, but pre-order purchase is available now. So go ahead and go and look that up. Peter Kirschnow, it's the latest in the W.E.B. Griffin series, Zero Option, Men at War.
Yeah, I've got another one. Also, thanks for mentioning it, Bob. I also got another one that's going to be coming out soon to be released. I don't know when. It'll be sometime this year. It's called The Black Russian. It's I think it's the best of all of my novels. It's really it's a page turn. My agent thinks it's the best. We're hoping that maybe there's going to be a movie in the offing. So we'll see what happens. I just have fun writing them. It takes a little bit of time, but it's for me, it's like recreation.
Pete, I stumbled onto this, so I want to roll with it here. When I jokingly said, why would you want to sentence your wonderful grandchildren to college? What is your feeling on the value of college today? I don't know how much you pay attention to Charlie Kirk. People like Charlie Kirk at Turning Point, and of course, who's on the air after I'm off. Matt Walsh is one of the leading conservative commentators at the Daily Wire. He is another one who did not go to college, and these individuals are among the most well-educated, self-taught, self-read, and informed people. I mean, like I said, in the entire, you know, world of punditry, if you want to call it that, if you want to call them that, or media or what have you, and they are constantly talking about the college scam, the cost, given the, you know, the, given the amount of money that it, and investment that it takes to get a degree, the value of that degree and whether or lack thereof, and then of course having to be put up with indoctrinating, you know, wokeness, they're basically saying it is not worth your time unless you have a professional ambition that requires a degree, a medical degree, a law degree, an engineering degree, something of that nature, to just go to college the way we all used to say, yeah, of course we're going to go to college because that's just what you do, is a huge mistake now. You are, you know, you're an Ivy Leaguer. You're extraordinarily well versed in academia. What do you think about their message that kids should absolutely avoid college at this day and time, in this day and age? Maybe not historically, but for now, it's a bad investment.
I think it's a lukewarm message, actually. It's funny you mention it because last weekend, actually Friday and Saturday, I and my old college football teammates email each other constantly. We have this listserv where we're constantly, you know, we rib each other a lot, but we keep each other apprised of what's going on. And last week, the email was a fire with all of my football teammates talking about how the educational system has collapsed. And we're talking about it at the Ivy League level. We're talking about how I had originally mentioned to a number of people over a few years that I've noticed a lot of recent college and even law school graduates are not just uneducated, but their cognitive skills seem to have declined. One of my favorite novels is this novel called IQ 84, where the premise of it is that a virus was released and everybody's IQ goes down proportionally. Nobody notices it because, you know, the people who were smarter before are still smarter than other people, but everyone's getting progressively dumber. You know, it's kind of a fanciful thing, but you kind of wonder. The cognitive ability, the ability to think from point A to point B seems to have declined, and it's not just because I'm an old codger now and I look at this stuff. I mean, I can almost point to certain circumstances. I'm not going to mention anything about it, but I can point to certain circumstances where I've observed that. I'm interested in knowing whether or not some of your listeners have observed the same thing. But a number of my college teammates and other classmates have concurred. They said the same thing. And whether that's true or not, the fact of the matter is I think K through 12 in college education has a lot, I mean, they've got a lot to account for. I don't think we're doing a very good job of mass education, K through 12 or college or even postgrad. A hagiography is developed around education where you're not supposed to speak evil of any particular teachers or group of teachers or anything of that nature, but I think it's necessary to have a credible critique of what's happening. I don't think that we are progressing, we're not even progressing, I think we're regressing the way we should, but more important, at least in the temporal sphere, is that right now, not only are we not progressing in terms of substantive education, but the kind of concepts that are being taught the kind of moral rot that seems to have pervaded our educational system and so many other systems. Victor Davis Hanson, again, my favorite philosopher of the current times, has been on this for a long, long time. There is this kind of, lack of a better term, an evil miasma that's descended over much of academia. I don't want to wax philosophical about it, but you look at some of the educators, you look at some of the college presidents. I think it was a vivid example back when Lisa Stefanik asked Harvard, Penn, and MIT about, you know, very simple questions, and they equivocated about these things. They did not have the moral clarity. When you don't have moral clarity, you can't teach philosophy, but also when you don't have moral clarity, everything becomes relative, including math. Now, we've got math instruction at the K-12 level that's equity-adjusted. This is craziness on steroids. So, I don't mean to be an overzealous critic of the educational establishment, but somebody has to be. I'll leave it to Victor Davis Hanson because he's much more educated than I am, and he's got the time to think about these things. But, Bob, I think we're in trouble, big trouble.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a very, very great and complete answer. I find myself, and I've talked to you about this before, so I apologize for the redundancy. My wife always said that she was taught by her mother that school is 16 years. But back in, you know, the 70s when she was told that, in the 80s when she went into college, it was a different thing. It was a different time. The rate of expense and so forth was, I should say the inflation rate of college from then to now has so far exceeded anything else in terms of inflation. And between the cost and what is going on there, Peter, I just wonder if my grandchildren, I just stumbled across an email from you, by the way, because I wanted to pull up the article you sent me about saving Hamas, about why Biden is saving Hamas. And I just noticed one that I had missed about your granddaughter and what a phenomenal young athlete she is and being a chess prodigy as well. And I just think that's fantastic. And I'm thinking to myself, she's got such an amazing future in front of her. I wonder if she's going to end up in an Ivy League university. Now I watch the Ivy League universities, Peter, and what's going on between DEI, as well as obviously all of the radicalism and the protesting and the things that have been allowed to happen. They've canceled the commencement for Columbia, which they did at USC as well, mm-hmm. On the other coast. You know, so, and I'm thinking to myself, I wonder if Pete would push his granddaughter, as he did his daughter, you know, to achieve amazing things in the Ivy Leagues, or if that is something that, given this, the difference between the 80s and now, if maybe there's a better path, a path that doesn't involve $350,000 of debt.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. My daughter she followed me to Cornell. She's a legacy. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to Oxford in England and then to Harvard. And I used to be proud of that up until about, I'd say 8 or 9 years ago. And then I just fell silent. I don't think it's a badge of anything. Now, my daughter worked extremely hard at what she did, and she was in the sciences. She wasn't, and that doesn't necessarily mean anything anymore. And I can't speak for my daughter, but my sense is, because I know her and we've spoken about these things quite often, is she's not going to be pushing that for my granddaughters. I don't think that at all. In fact, I look at other schools. Hillsdale's a good example where your daughter went, mm-hmm. Where you're going to get a better education. There's no ifs, ands. Look, it hurts me to say this about my alma mater. I was really prideful, unfortunately, about going to an Ivy League school but that was 50 years ago. Okay, I thought, okay, that was an achievement. I worked hard. I got the grades, got the board scores and everything, and I worked at it. Not anymore. And as I've said before, a number of my college teammates, many of whom are donors, are less than enthusiastic about what's transpiring. We regularly, I on their behalf, actually, I'm the scribe. I don't have the money, but I'm the scribe for the guys who have the money, will tell the president and other trustees that you guys better up your game because this is pathetic. This is not how an Ivy League institution or any institution should be behaving. And this is America. We are not going to be able to maintain our standard of living or our standards, our competitive standards in the world. China is going to eat our lunch and other nations, too, if we allow this idiocy to prevail. And it's not simply just in terms of academic rot. There's a moral rot that I think has metastasized throughout much of academia. You look at some of these students who are protesting. They are doing and saying things that I personally consider, not all of them, and some of them may be misguided, but a lot of them are saying things that are just, frankly, evil and awful. I don't know what is going on in these institutions. I mean, I do know. I do know what's going on. That was rhetorical. I apologize for that. And what's going on in these institutions need to stop. I know that I was appalled. I was not just appalled. I was infuriated back in October when there was a professor at Cornell who was on the arts quad there, which is the big quad with, you know, all the, I mean, everybody congregates there or has to go through there at some point during the day, and proclaimed to the crowd that he was exhilarated by what he saw on October 7th. That kind of moral corruption has no place anywhere, let alone at an institution of purported higher learning. And the fact that he wasn't immediately fired tells you all you need to know about what's going on. I know that there are Cornell alums. I know one who's extremely wealthy here in Cleveland. I'm not sure if he's aware of that, although he regularly weighs in on these things. But I would exhort people to think hard about whether or not they want to fund this kind of moral rot, and not just moral rot, but even if you don't care about morals, which everyone should, because a good classical education inculcates people with moral standards, and we've abandoned that, but think about the fact that there is no rationality going on there. They can't think from point A to point B. When you equate Israel defending itself with Hamas, you have some serious thinking to do.
Well, you mean like Joe Biden does.
He had serious thinking to do well before this, but this is an example of his inability to distinguish between right and wrong, to take a leadership position, and same with his idiot vice president. I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say idiot vice president. I was always raised to treat anybody in a position of authority with at least a modicum of respect, but they must treat the United States and the American people, and frankly, our strongest ally in the Middle East, with some respect. And they're not doing that at all, because they're trying to kowtow to some people throughout the country in order to get certain electoral votes. That's all they're doing, well, and that, to me, is despicable.
In your defense, Pete, by the way, the people who raised you to have a modicum of respect for these offices had never met Kamala Harris. So all of that is out. Sorry, but all of that goes out the window, because that would have changed the way you were raised. Peter, let's just follow up on this for a moment here, because you had sent me an article written by Lee Smith, entitled Saving Hamas, and it's about why the Biden administration is throwing the full weight of the U.S. government at Israel to prevent it from routing Hamas. Now, this was from May 1st, so that was last week. In the last 24 hours, we have had two other things happen. The first one being that the Biden administration has officially abandoned Israel. And when I say officially, I mean in practicality. There hasn't been an official position statement or policy statement, but here's the quote. The U.S. reportedly put a hold last week on a weapons shipment to Israel, a stunning diplomatic shift as Benjamin Netanyahu prepares to go against the Biden administration's warnings about moving forward with a military invasion of the Gazan city of Rafah. The alleged pause in a large shipment of offensive weapons appears to be the first instance of the Biden administration withholding U.S.-made arms from Israel since October 7th. So that's part one of this. Part two, Pete, is one of the top leaders of Hamas. This is two separate stories, but you have to put one plus one together to get two here, and here's the other one. A top leader of Hamas, this is Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naeem Qassem. Remarks were translated by the Middle East Media Research Institute, saying, quote, Biden is under internal and external pressure because of his policy and approach. The pressure within America is more significant. He is at risk of losing the election because of Gaza. When the American people take a stand in support of Gaza, we salute and applaud them. America will no longer support Israel to such an extent, and without American support, Israel is nothing. We would not have to work hard in order to destroy Israel. Without American support, it will be destroyed. So here's one, Joe Biden withholding arms to Israel. Here's two, Hamas saying when Biden withholds arms from Israel, we destroy Israel. He is literally going to bring about the long chanted and desired mantra of from the river to the sea. Biden is going to help it happen if you put those two stories together. And you say what?
I say that needs to be told to everybody in America and explained. And I think, among other things, Trump will do it if he ever gets out of a courtroom. And I think he's actually doing more effectively than almost anybody, because all eyes are on Trump when he is in the courtroom or coming out of the courtroom, and he addresses these things. But I use the term despicable so often, unfortunately, and I'm trying to think of another term to use that's equally forceful. Look, put aside aside the undergirding of anti-Semitism that runs through much of all the things we're seeing today, put that aside, okay? It's hard to do, and I tell you, as a member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, I see it all the time, and we could talk about that and the initiatives I had proposed at the Civil Rights Commission that went nowhere because of my progressive colleagues. But put that aside and just think about United States and world strategic interests, the West's strategic interests. After 9/11, the one nation that stepped up faster and more effectively than any other nation in the world was Israel in the protection of the United States, because they are in the worst neighborhood in the world, and they knew our enemies, those who had struck us, better than anybody else, and they went out of their way to supply us with intelligence, everything in the world to help us in that regard. Right after 9/11, I do remember one other thing, too. And I remember the video of this, which was quickly suppressed because we have so many people in the United States media who are sympathizers to Hamas. And I'm not exaggerating that at all. They suppressed what I saw on a regular, and you won't even see this on videos anymore. I look for it. But I remember, and you probably do too, and I bet you many of your listeners remember, the jubilation in Gaza among the Palestinians. They were waving Palestinian flags. They were yelling and cheering at the sight of the World Trade Center towers falling. And I never forgot that. I guess I had been oblivious to what was going on. I thought that everybody was not everybody's our friend, but I thought that, you know, we had given billions and billions in aid, and I thought that, okay, they would be sympathetic to our plight. No. They were cheering the demise of New York City, maybe the United States of America, or at least the temporary hit that we took, the 3,000 people who had been killed, the stunning sight of the most iconic two buildings in the world crumbling. They were cheering that, cheering it. I haven't forgotten that, and I'm not going to forget it, and until such time as I see that they've changed their position and they are not supporters of Iran and many of our other existential enemies, I'm going to be very, very skeptical of anything that we do to support them. I know this much. Israel is our ally. They've been unwavering. Yes, they need us desperately because they're in the worst neighborhood in the world and everybody else seems to be supporting their enemies. But my goodness, we have friends in Israel. They have Israel has friends here. We cooperate on a regular basis. I think we have to stand by our allies. Otherwise, America stands for nothing.
Completely concur. Peter, we'll talk more right after this time out. It's Always Right Radio on AM 1420.
The Answer.
Okay, 10:36. We get another segment here with Peter Kersenow, our favorite commentator. Peter, thank you so much for sticking with us. I got a couple of things I want to hit you with this segment. I want to start with DEI, and we'll go back to somewhat the Ivy Leagues. MIT is not an Ivy League, but it's considered one of the elite academic institutions, obviously. MIT has recently made the decision to abandon DEI requirements for when it comes to hiring. The decision was made by MIT President Sally Bluth, with support from the school's provost and six academic deans, saying, quote, "My goals are to tap into the full scope of human talent, to bring the very best to MIT, and to make sure they thrive once here. We can build an inclusive environment in many ways, but compelled statements impinge on freedom and expression, and they don't work." She cited, in 2023, the university's Department of Nuclear Science and Engineering. They were seeking an assistant professor in fields from fundamental nuclear science to practical applications of nuclear technology and energy security and quantum engineering. One might think, Pete, that the number one qualification here is going to be the ability to work in nuclear science and engineering. But these applicants had to submit a statement regarding their views on diversity, inclusion, and belonging, including past and current contributions to those, as well as their vision and plans for the future in these areas. Again, the insanity of that speaks for itself, but MIT is the latest school to say, the way they did down in Florida, which was a result of a Florida law, they killed at the University of Florida their entire DEI department. But MIT now is the latest and perhaps the most prominent school to say, okay, we're done with the DEI stuff. And you say what?
I say, first of all, it would be expected that one of the first to completely reject it. And it hasn't completely rejected, and we can talk about that at some other time. Mm-hmm. But at least it has rejected some of the fundamentals of DEI, would be a STEM school where, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, okay, and you can't fudge things very well, otherwise planes start to fall out of the sky and nuclear reactors explode. I mean, there's some real consequences. So what if you think Chaucer should be black? You know, big deal, okay? that's not going to have real-world consequences, although it does have kind of a moral rot attached to it. But nonetheless, it's a beginning, and we're very hopeful that this will spread, although it's going to take time. You know, I don't think any of us should fool ourselves into thinking that the DEI professorate or the DEI establishment is going to relinquish its power, and it has almost unyielding power in a number of institutions that easily. This is a philosophy. It's a pseudo-Marxist philosophy. I would say, I've referred to Gramsci in the past. It's a cultural Marxist philosophy, which will eventually yield to economic Marxism and all every other kind of Marxism you can think of. But the bottom line is, it's rot. It's moral rot. And we should abandon. It's the antithesis of Martin Luther King's famous statement of content of character versus color of skin. And, I've been... My conservative colleagues and I have been fighting the good fight, the Civil Rights Commission, for a long time. It's been an uphill battle. It still remains a prodigious uphill battle. But it's a battle that is necessary for the American experiment to work. America is, I think, in its essence, even though they didn't articulate it 200 years before Martin Luther King, but the founding fathers, and, you know, this is one of the problems we've got, is we've got an historical perspective. At many universities, they tried to do some moral preening and virtue signaling by saying the founding fathers were these awful racists and slaveholders and everything else like that. Okay, I'll give them some of that. They were indeed slaveholders, but they were also some of the most brilliant and profound individuals in the history of the world, and would that some of our current politicians had one-tenth of their intellectual capability. But nonetheless, we look at the progression of America, and it's the complete opposite of the DEI. We try to strive to not look at somebody's race or all the other superficial characteristics and look at their character versus their skin, their race, their ethnicity, their sex, all those things. So it's a small step. I applaud it. Because I'm in the middle of the fight, I know what an uphill battle it is. It's not going to be done in months, years. It's going to take decades to get to a point where, you know, we're at least moving in the direction that Martin Luther King, and I don't cite Martin Luther King Jr. as like just the be-all and end-all, the lodestar, but the things that he said have moral resonance that transcend the decades, transcend the centuries. And if the United States adheres to them, which are nothing more, frankly, than a restating of what the founding fathers had said, then we're going to be in good shape. But if we go down the DEI path, continue to go down the DEI path, we're going to see the kind of corruption that we see at so many institutions, in the media, in academia, and even in some of our corporations, and definitely in politics. The obsession with identity versus integrity and character is going to be the death of us. And Victor Davis Hanson's been writing about this for a long time. His most recent article is maybe the most chilling, where he talks about, you know, civilization basically declining and the various, I think it's the one from yesterday or so, but he talks because only he has, not only he, but only someone like him with his historical backing can understand the decline of civilizations. And he's afraid that civilization is imploding right now. And one of the reasons for it is this moral relativism, which is one of, I don't even know if it's the outgrowth of DEI. I don't think it is. I think it's maybe one of the generators of DEI. Anyway, they're symbiotic. And it's one of the things that troubles, I think, many of us about the direction in which the United States is going. We see a decline in standards overall. So anyway, long-winded response, Bob. I apologize for that. But I think it's imperative that we extinguish the whole DEI superstructure from K through 12 through college and grad school, and to the extent it's infected, and it has to a large extent, many of our major institutions, employers, and so forth. It's in the government. It's fused virtually everything. And it's, again, I'll say to you again, for all those who've heard me say before, go to Yuri Bezmenov, the KGB defector's prescription, when he described what the KGB was trying to do. It didn't happen before the Soviet Union fell, but it's happening right now. 1984, Yuri Bezmenov, there was an interview of him. I think it's somewhere on YouTube. I can't find it anymore, but if somebody can find it, read it. It's chilling. It's chilling. He's describing precisely what we're seeing today.
Yeah, it's still available. It's still available. I've seen it. I've watched it, and I've read his comments too. And yeah, you're exactly right about that. Pete, going back to what you said about MLK, and you know, not that it's the be all end all, but he's obviously the most prominent person with the most prominent statement about content of character. And you're exactly right. This is how it's supposed to be. You said it'll be decades before we see any progress there at all. I just wonder if we have decades to survive. I mean,
yeah, well,
you know, I mean,
Davis Hanson is worried about that.
Yeah. Yeah, I am too, and I love when you send me VDH and stuff. By the way, he's tremendous, as are you. But I just wonder. I mean, you know, this MIT thing is a very, very small baby step, and a couple of other colleges have done the same thing, as I noted. But I just don't know if we have that kind of a pace. I feel like this can't be. I mean, it does have to be a long game, but there has to be significant progress made in the short term toward that long game effort, or else I just don't think we're around to. I mean. Again, they're screening nuclear technicians based on their feelings of inclusion and diversity as opposed to their capabilities, Pete. That's, again, one small thing, and you and I have talked at length about doctors and about pilots and about other people who put lives in hands. If they're going to continue this stuff for any significant period of time and we don't make bigger steps than baby steps, I don't know if we get to that decades period where the kind of country we have even matters anymore.
Yeah, I agree. The thing that heartens me is that I talk to a lot of your listeners when I have the good fortune of being invited to speak at different places, and a recurring theme, you know, after my remarks, people come up and we're talking, is I think most Americans get it and are alarmed also because they get it, and they're concerned that we only have a finite period of time in which to right the ship, and they're determined to do so. I talk to a lot of veterans especially. I mean, these are the guys who put their lives on the lines. They're ones who, you're not going to be dissuading them. You're not going to make them put down their arms, so to speak. They fought for this country. They put their lives on the line for the country. So they're going to make sure that the American experiment survives. And they're very alarmed about these. I don't want to speak for everybody, but everyone has a sense that we've gone off the deep end here. We're accelerating in the wrong direction. We do see a few speed bumps along the decline. And I think that's why a lot of folks, and I'm going off a little bit of on a tangent, but I think it's consistent with what we're talking about. So many folks now understand the urgency. They understand that this isn't business as usual. That's why a character, and he is a character, like Donald Trump, is imperative. They see him almost as a savior. He's the only one they see, whether it's true or not, who has the strength to stop this decline. But putting him aside for the moment, I think that a lot of them who I've spoken to have concerns about almost every major institution. They want to know what they can do to stop the decline. And I won't say to a person, but I'd say 90% of the people with whom I speak, you know, they go beyond politics, they go beyond business and the educational establishments, and they understand, because most of them are of a certain age, they're above the age of 50, they believe that philosophically there's a moral decay that has afflicted the country. There's been a slow erosion and abandonment of our religious institutions, and our religious institutions haven't been doing enough, haven't been vigorously fighting enough to make sure that the moral center of the country holds. And we have a lot of folks in the media who like to make fun of churches or the religious, and, you know, they're the great unwashed. Hillary Clinton, you know, and others would make fun of them. And they do so at their peril, first of all, because I think there's so many, and I think that they will vote against these progressives. But more importantly, is they do so at the peril because if they prevail, we're looking at the end of the United States as we know it. And if you see the end of the United States as you know it, the world is an extremely dark place. And anyway, I'm very poorly equipped to talk about these philosophical things, but I have in my gut, Bob, you and I, you know, we both are pretty, somewhat faithful, I would say. I'll speak for myself. And I know that It's about the only thing that I can depend on to make sure that we continue to proceed in the right direction. Can't depend on man, can't depend on various, you know, man-made institutions. And I think we have to, I think my own view is, and I guess we probably lost a lot of listeners here who said this is boring as can be, but I think unless have a moral center and are unabashed by it, are unabashed by it, grasp it. I mean, the strongest men I've known in my life are the guys who were the most faithful men, whether it be military men that I've known, whether it be my college teammates. They've been the guys who've grasped God and are unafraid. They're unabashed, and they don't get, because they're strong enough. They're big enough and bad enough. They're not afraid about people looking at them as, you know, churchgoers being, you know, kind of wimpy guys. These were not wimpy guys. As I said, the strongest, baddest men I know are the guys who are the most faithful, and we need to recapture that for the United States of America to prevail.
Yeah, and you know what, Peter? It's not boring at all. It is so important to hit these things and to hit them hard and to be repetitive and redundant sometimes, because you know the old adage about breaking a rock: it isn't the last blow that does it; it is, you know, the thousand that came before it. And we have to keep saying it again and again and again to bring this home to people. By the way, the Bezmenov interview, I just sent you an email, Pete, with a great summary article. It was ran in 2023 from Big Think. There contained within it is the link to the YouTube video. So it's about an hour and 20 minutes long, the full thing with Bezmenov. And, Peter, I'm saying it to you because I want to say this to everybody else as well. I'm going to post it on my Facebook page and on my Twitter page and on my Truth Social page, because more people need to hear this. People who have never heard from or of Bezmenov need to know exactly what this defector said. He laid it out in a four-pronged platform approach to destroy this country. And it's a warning. It's a warning that not enough Americans are aware of. Or if they were aware of it in the short term afterwards, they have forgotten about it since. And everybody should watch it. So I will post it. Because you mention it on a semi-regular basis. You talk about Bezmenov because...
There are a number of things philosophically that affect me, and I always remember them. And one of the things that I always kept in mind, because I'm a man of a certain age. Look, I've been around. I've seen a lot of things, and I've heard, you know, fashions of the day come and go. But one guy who needs to be revisited, he didn't present well, and maybe some of the things he said were way off, but a guy who seems to be very prescient is McCarthy, Eugene McCarthy. I think that they talk about McCarthyism. Well, you know what? He was concerned about the spread of communism throughout the United States, and he was derided for that, and that it affected certain institutions. But I'm not sure that this is Soviet-driven or Chinese-driven communism, but we've got this sickness that's pervaded many of our governmental institutions that is no longer just a soft kind of socialism. It's flat-out communism. You look at the drivers of the Biden regime, the people who are in charge of moving the philosophy of the Biden regime, and ask yourself, how do they vary? How can you distinguish them from the old line, not just socialists, but communists of the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
I don't know. Peter, you still there?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you cut for a second there. Okay. And Peter, I don't know how to respond to some of that. I wanted to share with you before we move on to the next step in averting what you and I are describing and the long game that I talked about, that we won't be around to survive, or we won't survive to see. And that, of course, is this November in a moment. But I was, I wanted to describe very briefly what this Bezmenov prediction was. It was a prediction, and it was essentially kind of a warning label, if you will, a guide going forward. Bezmenov, his interview with G. Edward Griffin was entitled "Deception Was My Job," and I mentioned four tenets. It's four stages, is the accurate language here, of ideological subversion that has been created by radical Marxists to indoctrinate and weaken nations from within. And Pete, I read that to say, it's not just this nation. We're the tip of the spear. We're the most powerful and the most successful and the most extraordinary nation in the history of humanity. But it's not just this nation. The goal of Marxist subversion to take down nations, plural, it's the entire West. They're looking at the entire West, Western civilization that they want to take down. We just happen to be the number one target for this. And Pete, 1984, it's probably not coincidental that this interview was done then, given 1984, you know, from Orwell. But we're watching right now, the very things he predicted have been coming true for years and years and years now. And I wonder if we don't get this right, I'll tie this in now, if we don't get this right in 6 months, if all of this is indeed, you know, it's going to be put on a fast track. I'm talking about the law. You talked about decades to try to come back from the DEI and from the, you know, the Marxism and the destruction of this country from within. They're talking about killing it a lot faster. And so I'm tying all of this stuff together here, and I'm looking at the warning signs, and then I'm looking at where we are 6 months from now, and I wonder, can we survive past the next 6 months if we don't get it right in November? Or if all of those things that Bezmenov laid out, that you are warning about, that you teach us every single Tuesday on this program, Pete, if they aren't going to be put on a, you know, on warp speed, to borrow a phrase, Operation Warp Speed toward the destruction of this country. Am I overstating that, or is that too far?
I don't think you're overstating it. And I think we're always reluctant to say things like that because we've been, people like us have been derided for a long time. And I don't want to be histrionic about it either. I want to be measured about it. But when you have historians like, and again, I'll just mention Victor Davis Hanson, when you have a number of historians who say that we're at this tipping point that I've been talking about for a number of years now, and civilizations have tipping points that sometimes last decades, if not centuries, but we're at this point now where it's an inflection point. We know, we see certain markers that anybody who frankly has any kind of sense of reality knows that you can't continue to go down this path, otherwise there are going to be dire consequences. And anyone who's known just a little bit of history knows there are certain things that a society cannot long abide before it implodes. And so a lot of very smart people, people who've studied this for a long time, have been saying precisely what we've been talking about here, Bob. And again, don't want to be alarmist about it, but we've got to take the measures necessary to make sure we don't go down that downward slope pell-mell. And one of those things...
We kind of have to be alarmist, though, right, Pete? I mean, yeah, and yeah, I know I why you say that. Like I said to you when I just laid all that out, and I said, am I going too far? Probably, but necessarily. We have to be alarmist. The alarm should be sounding.
Yeah, unfortunately, because we're arrayed against us is almost the entire media, and almost every establishment's arrayed against us. So they will do everything they can to seize upon anything to discredit us. You don't want to appear to be alarmist. You have to be somewhat sedate and composed when you say these things. Victor Davis Hanson, I think, does a good job of that, being very understated. But when you read Victor Davis Hanson and you read The Ultimate Conclusions, your hair is, you know, standing on end. Mine isn't, of course. But you're going like, whoa, buddy, here's a guy who understands the millennia of human existence and the coming and going of civilizations, and are saying, like, wait, we're at that point right now. This is a bad, bad time right now, and it's very dangerous. I think we need to learn how to be, and I try to do this all the time, be as persuasive as possible. With your audience, it's easier because they get us, okay? They're with us on most of these things. But I try to train myself so that, as any good lawyer, I can be persuasive to a so-called jury. So I don't appear to be running around with my hair on fire, that I'm making exaggerated statements and coming to ridiculous conclusions. You want to show from point A to Z how we're getting there. And right now, we're not at Z, but we're maybe at W. You know, it's time that we need seriously. We've got an election coming up, and it's maybe not the most important thing in the grand scheme of things, but it is one of the most important things of the last couple of decades. We can't continue to go down the Biden path. This is horrible, what's happening. I think everybody concurs. Gas prices, inflation, crime, immigration, you name it, all those things. Wars proliferating across the world. But more importantly is the erosion of the American experiment. The American ideals to which we adhere is being denigrated, is being cast aside, and so many of our institutions are populated by people who just 30 years ago would be considered to be, you know, frankly, radicals, and in some cases, flat-out anti-American. So your listening audience, whom I think I know fairly well, all of us, need to be working extremely hard to preserve the American ideal. This is the greatest nation in the history of the world. If we want to continue to keep it as such, we've got to make the sacrifices similar to what so many Americans have done over the last 200 years. Now's the time to do it.
No question about it. I wish I had more time to talk more about what they're doing to President Trump in order to stop all you know, the, you know, right. what we're trying to do here. Stormy Daniels testifies today. Michael Cohen is going to be testifying in the next few days. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is not allowed to respond to any of the lies being told to him, or else they're going to put him in jail.
Yeah, he's the threat to democracy. He's the threat to democracy.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Peter Kersenow, thank you for the lesson. As always, my friend, it's a pleasure. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Bob.
You got it. It's 10:58. The last hour is yours. 216-901-0945. Join us and Always Right today.
You and I have
this hour of Always Right Radio is brought to you by The Floor King and KeepingMedicareSimple.com.
You and I know and do not believe that life is so dear and peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. If nothing in life is worth dying for, when did this begin? Just in the face of this enemy? Or should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery under the Pharaohs? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have thrown down their guns and refused to fire the shot heard round the world? The martyrs of history were not fools. And our honored dead, who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis, didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay. There is a point beyond which they must not advance.
This is Always Right Radio with Bob France on AM 1420, The Answer.
All right, hour number three is underway at 9 minutes past 11 o'clock on this Tuesday. It's the seventh morning of the fifth month of the year of our Lord, 2024. Appreciate you being with us and welcome you now to join us at 216-901-0945. We want you to comment on anything that you see fit, anything that we've talked about in the Kersenow interview, anything that we covered in the top nine at nine, whatever you've got on your mind. We will take your calls on. It looks like there's a lot of people fired up and ready to go right now. Before I do that, though, I want to just remind you, because Pete talks about Yuri Bezmenov on a fairly regular basis, as he pointed out, and because there are certain principles, certain really hard and important immutable facts that need to be brought forth, and sometimes there are, I don't know, seminal moments that that kind of help clarify and cut through some of the thicket of misinformation and so forth out there. We are a glorious nation. We are blessed by God. We are the greatest force for good in the history of human civilization, as I have said many, many times. But we are not without flaws. Historical flaws and modern flaws. Now, some of the historical flaws were flaws of our own creation. And so many people worked their entire lives to remedy those things, to fix those things, to make up for those things. The flaws that we have within our country right now are a little bit different, because the flaws that we have now are, dare I say, existential. Because we are literally talking about our survival as a country, as a republic, as we know it now. There are forces that are working outside of the United States to take us down from within inside of the United States. And sadly, there are the bad actors, the important players in this game, that are within the leadership of the United States, that are working and conspiring with them, with those outside global forces, which is what Pete and I were talking about in some depth. Yuri Bezmenov, the Russian, Soviet Russian defector, he was an informant and a KGB operative who defected to the United States in the early 70s. And he did an interview in 1984 that Pete is talking about that is a little hard to find anymore. But you can find it, and I found it, and I'm going to, again, post it on my Twitter and Facebook pages by the end of this show so that you can watch it. It's an hour and 20 minutes you will not forget. It's an hour and 20 minutes that you should devote yourself to. Just pretend you're turning on a 90-minute movie, a made-for-TV movie. Put it up on your phone or on your TV if you can do YouTube on your TV with streaming and so forth. But watch this interview and tell me it doesn't change your entire perspective on things, your entire outlook, because it will. And I will say this. If you are not watching this 1984 interview in 2024, If you're not watching this 40 years on, you are bringing about, and I mean this pretty much literally, you are bringing about the end of the Republic as they intended it to be. You understand what I mean? If we don't learn the lessons from those who are providing the material, those who have been through it, those who knew exactly what and know exactly what the communist goals are and so forth, if we're not watching these things, taking notes, seeing what is happening before our very eyes, and realizing what the end holds for us, we are actively bringing about that end. I'm trying to find a better way to say that, and I don't know if I can. But we are actively bringing about our own country's destruction. And that doesn't mean nuclear destruction necessarily, but it's destruction from a cultural, from a an existential, from an economical, and from a military standpoint. Our destruction will be at hand. Because the goal of the Marxists is to indoctrinate our children and weaken the nations from within. And it is happening right now. Now, everything that Bezmenov warned of is happening right now. 40 years on, we are closer to it than ever before. And they're willing to play that long game that, as I told Peter, we cannot afford to play. We have to take bigger steps than baby steps. And we have to think about this in the short term. Watch the video. It's worth your time. Just seriously, watch the interview with Bezmenov. Sally is in Berea. Sally, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Good morning. Go right ahead.
Hi, Bob. This is on the topic of elections.
Okay.
And it's not too early to be advocating, as you always do, for early voting. This election is way too crucial to be taking any chances. And there's no excuse not to be able to do that. The election boards go out of their way to be helpful. I could speak for Cuyahoga County, but we took a friend that is disabled, and they were even willing to bring the ballot out for her to vote in the comfort of the car. She didn't even have to go in. And we are always happy to give rides to people, not rush hour to fellow conservatives. Yes, any way to get voters to down there to vote early, because it's kind of a pain to get from far-reaching suburb downtown, but
yeah,
we have to make the effort. And it's, if there's no way that somebody can vote early, then vote by mail very early. You can register as early as September to get on the process. And then when the ballots are available, you're on the rolls to get it started out and get your mail-in ballot and get it in time. And you can always check it online or on the phone that they got the ballot. But the ideal is just to vote in person as soon as possible. And that's it. Let's get her done.
Get her done, indeed. Well said. Thank you very much, Sally. I find myself torn on this subject for obvious reasons, as I've said many times. I'm torn because I don't like the idea of early voting. Like so many others, I want to vote on Election Day. I also don't like the idea of mail-in voting. I want to vote in person. In fact, I want to vote everybody in person on Election Day, and then that should be it. There should be no month-long voting period. Absentee ballots should be able to be cast only for those who are serving in the military overseas and cannot be home for an election, or for people who are literally working in other locations rather than their home state, if they have, or they're in college in another state. You know, there has to be legitimate reasons, not just, I don't feel like going, so I'm going to mail it in. No, I think it absolutely should be limited to those who have no choice but to do an absentee ballot. So I don't like any of the new stuff. But where I come in with the conflict, you know, being conflicted, as I stated, is with the fact that it is what it is. And we have to either accept the new rules and then play by them and then beat them at it, or we are going to be left in the dust. And you're right. I have been beating people over the head with the vote early, the four quarters metaphor, the four quarters of a football game. You have to score points in all four quarters to win, not just in the last 2 minutes of the game, which is what Election Day looks like. You've got to score points in the first quarter, second quarter, third quarter. That means the first week, the second week, the third week of early voting, and the fourth week, and then in the two-minute warning, which is Election Day. You're exactly right, and it's not what I would prefer. It's not what I want, but if it is what is, you know, going to be required of us, then we have to fight to win. We have to play the game to win the game and not sit here and gripe about the fact that we don't like the new rules. So that's a great call. Thank you, Sally. Let's go to Steve in Collinwood. Steve, you're on the air. Fire away.
So Blinken stopped off in Israel last weekend, and he told the Israelis the policy was that those that are trying to murder you, maybe they're hungry or thirsty, so hurry up with the sandwiches. So they were packing, you know, humanitarian aid, diapers, food, at the Kerem Shalom crossing. And the result was the rocket attack. Five guys got killed and 17 were injured. And that changed the paradigm, because now Israel is occupying the Rafah crossing. And that is to show the Palestinians in Rafah that Hamas is not in control. That's the main thing, because they were controlling the border crossing. And you could get out of Gaza. It costs about $5,000-$6,000. Plus, you probably have to pay $1,000 to the Hamas guys to take you there or let you through. But
You through where? Into Egypt?
Yeah.
I didn't think Egypt was even with bribe money. I didn't think Egypt was taking any of them in.
Oh no! They're applying in Egypt because they have no status. There's like 10,000 of them in Egypt right now. But if you have money, it's the same thing in Gaza. There's plenty of food there, but you have to have money. But if you're just a peon,
you have to be a part of Hamas. Yeah. No. I mean, you have to have either power or money. You're exactly right, and that means Hamas. And they're the ones who have been starving out the Palestinian people, not the Israelis. Hamas.
They're still issuing paychecks, and they have $100 bills there. The other people have nothing.
Right.
So, but the policy now, the negotiation should be, because 70% of the hostages are dead, and maybe there's 30 to 45 left, and there's been no sign of life. So we don't even know if those are alive. They've given no sign of life to anybody.
I was going to say, I don't know where you're getting 70% from. I hope that at least that many are alive. Or I think you said 70% are dead. I don't know if any of them are alive. I don't know if they've all been killed now or just died because of the way they're being treated. I mean, God only knows. In any hostage negotiation, not that we're negotiating for the hostages here, but, you know, obviously this is a crucial part of this war. You know, you need proof of life. What you just said, you've got to show us that they're still alive so we know what we're fighting for. Because guess what? If we know they've killed them all, if the IDF knows they've killed them all, and maybe even if our lame duck, ridiculous administration, knows that the Americans who were included among those have been killed, then maybe we just say, the hell with it, and go get them. Go get them all. Destroy them, even if there is collateral damage.
Jews are not good at negotiating for hostages. If you remember, in the Gilad Shalit trade, they traded 1,000 for one, and then in the last exchange for 130, they let four or five, you know, an enormous number of very bad people.
Who were being held in jails after being convicted of crimes, they were treating them as if they were also hostages being held by Israel, which again is a complete fabrication. It's not true. Being convicted of a crime and put in a jail cell is different than being taken hostage in an invasion, which is exactly what Hamas did.
Well, I'm more worried about. I mean, the leaders of Hamas. They're going to try and figure out how to get them. If there is some type of ceasefire, that'll also be to get them out of there, that they'll save them. Because my biggest worry is that I don't know, but I'd like to know if the Biden administration knew about this, about the October 7th attack prior to it, and allowed it to go on, figuring it would be smaller and it would topple Netanyahu. Which is, like I said, has been their political aim from the beginning.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who say that, and Netanyahu is not popular, and I understand. I do. Netanyahu is very Trumpy to me. Benjamin Netanyahu is very much to a lot of the left-wing Israelis, and others who are, non-Jews who live in Israel. They don't like Benjamin Netanyahu for the same reason that the left hates President Trump.
It's exactly. It's almost like the Stern father syndrome. They're against this here and there. It's like it's nuts. But anyways, have a great day.
Got it.
And love your show.
Thank you. Appreciate your call. Great stuff there, Steve. Thank you so much. Let's go to Tony in South Euclid. Tony again. Hey, Tony, fire away.
Yes, how you doing, sir? Thanks for taking my call. And I just want to mention about Mr. Kersenall, his great vocabulary in explaining in his old way about our world, our Constitution. And I just wanted to stem off that a little bit and say that, you know, this is an experiment. This was an experiment by our founding fathers. And we need not to worry. And I know the media has to kind of perpetuate certain things to get people interested. But, you know, there's no fear. This is what always was taught to me when I was younger. The good will always prevail. No matter what wars, what problems you run into, the good will always prevail. And thank God for President Trump, because he's one of those that are really standing out. And there's going to be other President Trumps down the road, not exactly, but similar. And we're going to have these people, and it'll always be in balance. And that's the way our Constitution is built, is that it will always make it in balance, no matter the corruption, no matter the things, the right, the left. It's always going to end up that it's going to be for our benefit. And it's just too bad that these other countries can't follow the same that we have developed, 200 years ago. But, you know, maybe they'll learn. And we know that it's always a fight for power, and we have to find a way to balance it out. And I just want to repeat myself and say, look, the good will always prevail. Just keep at it. We'll listen to your program. We'll listen to other positive things, and everything will be fine.
Well, thank you for the call, Tony, and thanks for the message. And yeah, positivity is a big part of it. And I know I am guilty of negativity because I see what's going on in the world, and we have to call these things out. But it's not with the intention of hang your head in despair and grief. It's with the intention of, oh my gosh, we have to do something about that, and we have to step up, stand up, and push back and fight. And that is exactly what we do have to do. So I'm glad, and I appreciate the affirmation of the show and certainly of Peter Kersenow. You're right. He clarifies it and cuts through it the way very few people can. He puts it into terms people can understand, and he cites important information from others, like I said, from Yuri Bezmenov, for example, so that you really, really, truly know what's going on. It's hard to win a war if you don't know the rules. It's hard to win a football game, a baseball game, if you don't know the opponent's strategy. It's hard to come up with a counter strategy if you don't know what theirs is, to come up with a game plan. Pick your metaphor. But if you don't really understand what the other side is trying to do to you, you don't know how to properly prepare to stop it. And so you need to know what they're trying to do to us. That's why every single day I bring you all of this information the best I can with the experts from not only around Northeast Ohio, but from around the country that can spell it out better than anybody else so that we know how to fight the fight. And it's hard. Nothing worth doing is ever easy. You know what I mean? If it was easy to be thin and healthy and with great, great cardio, a high metabolism and feeling great all of the time, if it was easy to do that, everybody would do it. Nobody would choose to be overweight and out of shape and with needing heart monitors and heart medication all the time because of that. People would, but it's hard. It's hard work. If it was easy to, make $1 million, everybody would be doing it. But you know what? The select few who can do that work very, very hard. And I'm talking about those who earn it, not those who just inherit it. I'm talking about those who put a shingle on the door and say, I'm open for business and I'm going to make my way. And I'm going to sacrifice here and there. And I'm going to work harder. I'm going to educate myself here. I'm going to learn more about that. I'm going to expand this. It's a hard thing to do great things. Well, it's very, very hard to protect a functioning democratic republic like ours. It's very, very hard to protect it, preserve it, because there are people who are always going to try to tear it down. But it's worth doing.
It's worth doing to be in shape, to be healthy. It's worth doing to try to advance and grow your career and grow your operation and grow your business and to try to make the most of it so that you can then pass on that opportunity to others by hiring them and giving them an opportunity. And yes, it is worth it. It is worth it for us to protect this republic, the Constitution that made it possible for us, from all of those who are trying to tear it apart. We'll be back.
The Answer.
All right, 11:34, Always Right Radio and AM 1420, The Answer. Take a few more phone calls here before the end of the show. We'll hand it off to Bill O'Reilly to take to the top of the hour. Then you get the aforementioned Charlie Kirk. Make sure you listen to Charlie. Make sure you listen to Dennis Prager. We got a great afternoon lined up for you as well. 216-901-0945. We'll go to, speaking of Charlie, Charlie in Brownhelm, not Charlie Kirk. Hey, Charlie, go ahead.
Hey, Bob, thank you for taking the call. And very interesting. I'm going to check out this jury guy as soon as you get off the show. But more existential. This is something that I never thought of. But last night, Newt Gingrich was on fire on Fox and followed up right with Laura Trump, saying that the judge has opened the door for Trump to go to jail is an existential threat to the United States, because Newt Gingrich says they will not let him run. He will not be on the ballot if he goes to jail. By opening the door and saying,
who's
we're going to put him in jail? This, when the judge said,
when you said they won't let him run, who's they?
The Democrats. They're going to keep him in jail, or
The Democrats can't choose the Republican nominee, and if the Republican nominee is in a jail cell, particularly because of a political maneuver like this, the Republican voters can still decide he's their nominee. He's going to run. He's going to be on the ballot no matter what.
Luke says our Constitution's done if he goes to jail, because he won't be let out and he may die in jail. And then Laura Trump says, what kind of country will we have if they can put the leading candidate in jail? They can put anyone in jail. Yeah. And it's going to, but that, I couldn't believe he was saying, as a constitutional historian, he's saying this is it. That's on our doorstep. If they put him in jail, the country's done.
So you mean if they convict him of these felonies? You mean like if
they're going to put him in jail and keep him in jail? Is what Newt? You got to watch it. It's on Fox last night. I think it was on Hannity.
No, I know. But what I mean is the current threat to put him in jail is over contempt for violating a gag order. You don't mean if he just goes to jail, because there's a difference between jail and prison. And I don't like when people do that. They say jail when they mean prison. You mean convicting him of felonies and putting him in prison, sentence.
That's not what Newt was saying. He says if they open the door, they are going to do it, is what he said. And they're going to put him in jail so that he can't run. And that means maybe his safety. He's going to be threatened
He's not going to go to a prison. He's not going to go to a prison and be in jeopardy in general population. It'll never happen. That can't happen. And again, I didn't see the segment. But if he's talking about what Mershon is threatening to put him in jail for contempt of court because he's violating a gag order, that is also very, very different. That would be a local holding cell until, usually when they put somebody in jail for contempt, the judge usually says until such time as the offender is willing to apologize to the court and then not do it anymore. So, of course, that would be then a showdown whether Trump would ever say, okay, I apologize for violating the gag order, blah, blah, blah. But that's the short-term jail stuff. What we're talking about, though, or what I'm talking about, I didn't see Newt, Charlie, is what I'm talking about is if he is convicted of multiple felonies and actually given a prison sentence, that's a different story. First of all, he would never serve it with other people. It would never happen. Second of all, it still would not preclude him from running for office. Especially because he's not going to be put into a prison cell and actually be sentenced until within the next 6 months. The election is 6 months away. What they're going to do is continue to try to embarrass him, humiliate him, try to paint to the voters a picture of a guy who is standing trial for multiple felonies because he's a criminal, therefore you shouldn't vote for him. But it won't stop people from being able to vote for him. His trials are not going to end by November. His sentences are certainly not going to begin, if there were any sentences, by November. So he's going to be on the ballot. He's going to be the nominee. He's going to be up there against Biden. They're just trying to do everything they can to stop him. That's all.
Okay. Just check him out. Check Newt out. He was not saying what you're saying. He's saying that the judges even opened the door to jail is a constitutional crisis. If he goes to jail, the Constitution is being shredded. And he says, okay, these people are so desperate, they cannot. They think this is the end of the world if Trump wins. So they cannot let him be the candidate in November.
Yeah. So him going. Yeah, and I'm just going to tell you, I'm going to disagree based on your description of what Newt said. And thank you, Charlie, for the call, as always. I'm going to disagree with Newt based on what you said Newt said. If he goes to jail, meaning, again, holding. This is, you know, jail is typically for short-term incarceration, usually to hold if it's pretrial or something like contempt. Very, very different than prison. Prison is where you serve sentences, longer sentences. If he's talking about Judge Mershon sentencing him to or putting him in jail for contempt of court until he chooses to apologize, if he thinks that is going to lead to the end of the Constitution, I disagree. It is nothing more than the same election interference and political persecution we have seen before. If he goes to prison and is sentenced, let's say in the document scandal, or let's say in the Georgia, you know, election interference scandal, or whatever it is that they're calling, you know, his attempt to undo the Georgia elections. If he actually gets a prison sentence into an actual prison, first of all, he won't be in a general population setting. He would be kept in, you know, isolation or whatever it is that you want to call it, for his own protection, because he's a president, for crying out loud. That's just, you know, we've never crossed this bridge before, but a lot of people like that in positions of extreme authority or, you know, who are targets for other people. You know, he would be protected in such a way. But as far as whether or not he could be elected, if he is actually a convicted felon serving time in a federal or a state penitentiary, that's probably what Newt is talking about. And if that happens, yes, I agree. Then the country and the Constitution that defines it is dead. I would agree with that part. But the idea of opening the door to putting him in jail for violating a gag order, I do not think that would be the constitutional crisis that you're describing Newt is saying. That's just my opinion on it. TJ is next. Hi, TJ. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Bob. You know, when Peter brought up about McCarthy, you know, McCarthy wasn't the only one that seen the coming storm. You know, in 1968, and I told this one before, but I'm going to tell it again. I had a platoon sergeant in Vietnam that told me, son, we're fighting the wrong enemy here. And, you know, I kind of like poo-pooed. I said, well, they're a bunch of commie rats. He goes, yeah, they are. He says, but they're not a threat to us, son. He says, the real threat are the commies back in America. And, you know, I was a little bit puzzled. You know, I said, what do you mean, commies in America? He said, if you're lucky enough to get out of here alive and you go home, don't let them fool you. He said, these people give themselves fancy names. They call themselves progressives, liberals. He says, son, these are commie rats. And, you know, I watched since then. And, you know, during the Cold War, you know, this communism is not a quick-acting thing. It's like a slow evolving cancer. And during the Cold War, it kind of was put on remission. And then after the Cold War, it really started to spread through our people to the point now where it's damn near half the country are buying into this crap. So this has been a threat for a long time. And one other quick thing, Bob, if you can get that, they were showing Biden's chief economic advisor being interviewed. I can't believe it, but there's actually somebody in his administration that is even dumber than Kamala Harris. If you can get that interview tomorrow and play, the people will be shocked.
Which one are you talking about, TJ?
I can't think of his
name.
Is
he the one who didn't know about how the United States sells bonds?
Yes.
I did see a clip of that. I did see a clip of that. Embarrassing.
They got to hear that. I mean, how dumb. And this is his chief economic advisor.
Yeah, or one of them. He's like in the department. Like he's one of the guys who was he the chief who actually establishes.
Yeah.